Blog Talk Radio.
If I knew then what I know now, no, I wouldn't change much of anything anyhow. It was 50-50, and I won the coin toss when you danced with me at the Huntington's Waltz. When you danced with me at the Huntington's Waltz.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Live. Our show is brought to you by Help for HD International on Blog Talk Radio and is made possible by Teva Pharmaceuticals and the Griffin Foundation. I'm your host, Sharon Thomason, and I'm excited to have the amazing Terry Tempkin on the show with us today. Terry recently retired from the HD clinic at UC Davis, where she spent 19 years as an advanced registered nurse practitioner helping HD families navigate through their HD journey. She's also a medical advisor for Help for HD and sits on the executive board of directors. Today we're going to talk about some of the most important insights Terry has gained through her work with HD patients and families, and Terry's going to tell us about an upcoming event in Washington State. If you have questions for Terry, please feel free to call in at 310-982-4277. Again, that's 310-982-4277, or post your question in the chat room, and I will read it to Terry and see what her answer is. Welcome, Terry, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon, and thanks to all of you who have tuned in. I'm real excited to share some insights and tell you about the great work that we continue to do to help families with Huntington's disease.
That's awesome, Terry. Could you start by sharing with us a little bit about your background working with the HD community?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So, actually, in 1998, Dr. Wheelock, Vicki Wheelock, who was actually a personal friend of mine and my husband's, called and asked me. She said she was starting a Huntington's program at UC Davis. I was working in another health system. I'd never worked with anybody with Huntington's before, and said she was starting a new program at UC Davis, and did I know a nurse practitioner colleague. You know, she wasn't initially asking me, but she said, "Well, any of your colleagues looking for a job?" And I said, "Well, I am. I was looking to make a change." And she goes, "Oh my goodness, you mean you'd consider?" So that was how our working relationship evolved. It was kind of fortuitous that I happened to be looking at a time she wanted to build this program and hire someone. And then, as I don't know if your audience knows that the clinic at UC Davis actually started in 1996 through donations from a private foundation called the Roberson Foundation. Joe Roberson had been a successful businessman, and he created a foundation to support none other than a nurse at UC Davis. So there had been somebody in that job for a few years before Dr. Wheelock came on, but she left. And so the program was turned over to Dr. Wheelock, and then she added me in 1998, and then we built one of the biggest Huntington's disease clinics in the country. In addition to the clinic now has two physicians. They're still looking for my replacement. And a social worker, a psychiatrist who helps out in clinic, a genetic counselor. They have the full complement of providers for a Huntington's clinic that was built over the years, right? And they follow over 500 families with Huntington's disease.
Wow.
They also, in addition to their very strong clinical program, they've been a very strong research program. We participated in over 19 clinical trials for Huntington's disease during those years. And also, as many of your readers may know, that we started a stem cell therapy initiative, which hasn't quite gotten off the ground, but we got some great preliminary work for a stem cell therapy in Huntington's disease. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
I've been around the block a little. In collaboration with Dr. Noltz's lab.
Yeah, that is so promising, and I hope that that comes to fruition real soon.
We all do.
But you retired. You retired recently, just a few months ago, right?
I did. So, well, this is how I explain it. Is I retired from UC Davis, but I never retired from Huntington's disease. And so it came time for me to I'm a lot older than you guys think I am. And it was just time for me to retire. But, of course, my heart is still with the community. So I do a lot of volunteer work, primarily with Help for HD, because I love their mission and I love the spirit that they have. And I know that you guys, I'm not here necessarily to plug it, but I just want to share with the folks listening in that the mission of Help for HD to highlight the issues having to do with juvenile Huntington's, nobody else does this, and it's truly amazing. I know that Help for HD is bigger than that and more than that, but it's passion to champion the cause of the families that face issues with juvenile Huntington's is just off the charts awesome, and how could you not want to support those efforts? So, yeah, so in my retirement, that's what I'm doing. I just do it now without pay.
Well, I appreciate that, Terry, and we appreciate you so much, and we are so glad that you are continuing your work with the Huntington's community, because you have really made a difference in so many people's lives, and you continue to do that. Can you tell us about the upcoming Height Education Day in Washington State?
Oh, I'm delighted to. So HIGHT stands for, we're spelling that H-I, not H-Y,
right.
H-I-P-E, and it's an acronym for Highly Interactive Patient Education, or I'm sorry, Participant. Sorry, it's that medical thing. Can't get that patient word out. Highly Interactive Participant Education Event. So let me tell you what's really cool about this. This was a brainchild of the Help for HD folks, you guys. You know, the conferences are really great, and we're always so grateful to professionals and other people who give their time, essentially donate their time, to help educate people about issues and updates and research and stuff in managing Huntington's disease, and that's good. But HIGHT kind of turns the flow in the opposite direction. So in some of the areas, HIGHT rolled out in Sacramento last month, and it was a huge success. Up here in Seattle, which is, we've joined forces with the local Huntington's community up here to tag on to a conference that they had already planned. So the afternoon session will be the HIGHT session too. And what essentially happens is during the lunch hour, the morning will be as what people generally expect. You have invited speakers and they give their talks. And that's terrific, and we love that model. But we want
can
the
you
flow.
Tell us a little, can you tell us a little bit first about who the speakers are and what they're going to be talking about?
This up here, there's actually a lot of strong representation up here in the this conference will be based out of Kirkland and at Evergreen Hospital, Evergreen Health Center, which is a little bit north northeast of downtown Seattle, but it covers the greater Puget Sound area. All right, so you know, Washington is a smaller state, but its population center is centered around Seattle. So, and you know, south. Right. And this conference actually was started by Dr. Goodman a few years back. Once a year, she would put on a conference with speakers and give people updates on Huntington's and research and stuff. But they needed some help this year. So we reached out to join forces, and Dr. Goodman will start by giving an overview of what's new in Huntington's and an overview on research. We have an invited speaker who is doing a study on the interventions of laughter in people with neurologic diseases. So she's going to give a presentation on how laughter can help people cope with things that are difficult in their life. She's doing a research study, so it will be really interesting to see what her research is about. And it's specifically with folks who have neurologic conditions. We have
that's going to
Dr.
Be and I think she's going to do some interactive stuff, let people
I hope she's going to make them laugh.
A little sample. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think the audience might be a little bit of a test case.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Rosa Chung, who's a movement disorder neurologist with Swedish Health System, will be giving an update on the STAIR study, which is a study of irritability and Huntington's disease. And then lots of folks know Jimmy Pollard, who's going to give one of his talks. And that's all before lunch, so that's a pretty ambitious schedule. It is. And as you know, when we put on these things, we feed people well and have opportunities to, you know, to get up and stretch. And then at lunchtime, what folks will do is write down things that they have questions. We have an expert, so the HYPE program will be in the afternoon in this particular conference. We have a panel of experts. It'll be Dr. Goodman and Dr. Chong from the morning, myself, and then the Center of Excellence Social Worker, Susan Reynolds, who's very connected to the community up here. And the audience the participants will have a chance at lunchtime to think of things that they struggle with or want expert advice on, questions they might not get to ask when they see their providers, or something that came up for them during the conference in the morning. So they'll, you know, have a chance to jot down their questions, and in the afternoon, Katie will be the moderator for that panel and ask the questions that people submitted. What happened when they did this in Sacramento is it was just an amazing dialogue. I think there were a lot of things that were really helpful about it. One is the panel, the speakers and the panel got to hear what is really concerning about these, what families are concerned about.
Uh-huh.
I think that families really liked being able to have that connection, and I think they like being able to talk. I think they like the information going that way, as opposed to just coming off the stage out there that way. It was really successful, and we have every anticipation it will be equally successful in every single conference that we take this to this year.
I'm sure it will be. I've heard just glowing reviews of the Hike session in Sacramento, and I think we're going to see the same results at every single education day this year. What are some of the most common problems? You said people are going to write down problems and issues and questions. What are some of the most common problems or issues or questions that you've seen with HD patients and their families? And what advice do you have for dealing with those problems?
That's a really good question. We could fill up a whole lot of radio time, you know, talking about that. You know, Sharon, I think, you know, from many years' experience, issues that come up in some ways follow what kind of stage somebody is at. So folks who, say, like, are early in the disease or early in after their diagnosis have different issues than somebody who's end stage. And that's different than people who are in the middle stages, too. So, you know, I think one of the things that I learned is one size does not fit all. It just doesn't.
Absolutely.
And, and everybody's situation is unique. You have some folks who have a lot of resources in terms of they're financially more comfortable and they have a lot of family support. And then you have the opposite end of the spectrum where people struggle to even have housing and even have enough food and have no one. And it's everything in between. Right. So I think that this is what I think is kind of the why I love the concept of the Hike panel. Is because, you know, when you're on the other end of the phone, when somebody is in crisis mode or somebody is looking for advice or whatever, it actually is directed at where they are right now in that moment in time. And that's what people, participants at these conferences will actually get to do, ask questions in real time with experts who have experience of what they're dealing with at that time. You know, I know that I think one of the things historically that is really challenging for families is everyone knows that some people, not everybody, remember there is no unique characteristic about anything with Huntington's. And but I think some of the more intractable problems that take more thoughtfulness and more mindfulness and sometimes more intervention is when you have someone who may be getting symptoms of Huntington's, but they don't see it. You know, in the medical area, we call that unawareness of their symptoms.
And I want to make sure people
understand.
I'm sorry. Anosognosia is the name for that.
Well,
and it's different from denial.
It isn't denial. And I think that it's really important, since we brought that topic up, it's really important that people understand it's not like, okay, you know, that you're a diabetic and you're eating sugar and, you know, just, well, I'm just in denial. It isn't a consciousness. It's really a neurologic problem. They truly don't see it. They just don't get it. And it's not, they can't see it. And I think that's really hard. It is so, so very hard for their loved ones and family members because they want to get them to help. They want them to try to help them access resources. They want to try to improve the situation, but if that person has that unawareness, they may be resistant to all those efforts. And those situations are tough. Especially, not everybody does this, but sometimes in that unawareness, they're doing unsafe things. I saw people drain their bank accounts. I think it centers sometimes around jeopardy of their physical health, taking risks that don't seem reasonable to other people. And I think one of the big ones people struggle with is the driving issue, right? Right. If someone becomes more symptomatic and they don't think they're impaired and insist on driving, what happens then, right?
Mm-hmm. That can be a really tough one.
It's a tough one. And I think it's really tempting. In fact, I know it's really tempting to haul them into the doctor and say, you have to tell them, the doctor has to tell them to stop driving. Well, you know, sometimes that's helpful. And, you know, sometimes people listen, but my experience was more commonly they don't listen, right? That, okay. Well, they're not going to tell me I can't. Yeah, you're not going to tell me I can't drive. And
one thing that we have in Florida is that a doctor can report to the Department of Transportation that somebody is no longer safe to drive, and they pull their driver's license.
I'm not sure how many states have that. Well, all states have mandatory reporting laws, right? All states have them.
Okay.
How that gets enacted is different in every state. So, you know, you guys, I guess Florida can report it to the Department of Transportation. In California, you report it to the Department of Health. And then the Department of Health contacts the county that the person's address is in. So here's the thing. Here's what is tough. If you as a provider, say like you go and you see, you know, your doctor, your neurologist, your Huntington's doctor even, who knows about these issues, sometimes people are worried about their driving when in fact the worry may be a little premature. Not everybody as they become symptomatic is necessarily unsafe. And people who are, you know, in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have been driving a long time. And that's a skill set that for many people is highly retained. And so it's really hard to know. Your neurologist doesn't drive with that person. And so the judgment of when do you report and when do you not report, it's a tough judgment to make. You know, if they're taking the car, if their chorea is so horrible that they can't hold on to the steering wheel and they can't back the car out without banging into something, that's pretty obvious, right? That's pretty obvious. And and if they won't voluntarily stop driving, which is always the best, by the way, to have someone voluntarily stop, you know, so a barometer like that is a pretty easy call. But it's a lot harder than that, isn't it? Because there may be psychiatric changes or cognitive changes that make them an unsafe driver, but yet their skill set is there. So it isn't as easy as saying and the other thing is we tried everything, and I know the clinic still does this, and I think many providers do this, to try everything you possibly can before you report them. Because at the end of the day, you still want them as your patient. At the end of the day, you still want them to want to come see you so you can help them with all the other Huntington stuff. And, you know, if you report them and, you know, they get their license taken away, you potentially could jeopardize that trust with that patient. So,
right, and they get mad at you and just not come back.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I think that here was what we tried to do. And, you know, again, not one size fits all, and we would use this as a model, is if the family was saying, oh, they really can't drive, they've had a bunch of accidents, da-da-da-da-da, if the concern was it was very obvious that they don't, you know, that they should not be behind a wheel, you know, we would try our best efforts to get them to voluntarily not drive. And I have to say, in the, like, 19 years I was there, I think there it only reached a severity of maybe one or two times where we reported somebody. I mean, we just simply tried not to do that. The other thing is that sometimes families worry more about it than they should. And sitting in the clinic, I don't know the truth of that. I don't drive with them. I don't know the truth of it. The patient will be saying there, I can drive fine. The wife says, no, you can't. How do you discern the truth? So what we would recommend is that, and I think this works well as a model, is that the person should do an independent behind-the-wheel driving test, not with the DMV. Don't ever go to the DMV. The DMV might be punitive, right? And we don't want that. We don't want that to be punitive. But to go to, you know, the driving schools, how your kids learn to drive, go to driving school. They'll do a one-time behind-the-wheel independent driving evaluation. If they pass it, then they pass it and then recommend, depending upon, you know, how well they did, recommend doing it again in 6 months or doing it again in a year. If they don't pass it, then you have a third party who has no interest, who has no punitive interest in this. You have a third party saying, look, you really are not safe behind the wheel, and you should do the right thing. And I have to say, that is what we thought would be the most fair to people and what we used most often.
That sounds like it would be a really effective way to deal with it. Because you've got somebody who's actually riding with the driver.
And That's right.
It takes the caregiver and the doctor out of it.
Yes,
so there's
exactly.
Nobody for the patient to get upset with.
You know, and they may get upset with the driver they had, you know, but the problem is that, you know, there's a relationship. You want to preserve the relationship with the doctor for sure, but you also want to preserve the relationship with that care partner. If it's a spouse or a care, whoever it is, you want to preserve that relationship and not make, we all know that care partners face lots of things that, you know, they have to be the heavy on. And isn't it nice that they wouldn't have to be the heavy on this? And anyway, I think that that's one way to deal with it. Remember, there's lots of flavors, but, you know, out of fairness to the person who is struggling with the symptoms of Huntington's disease, they should be given the benefit of the doubt in terms of their ability, you know, again, unless it's very extreme and they've had multiple accidents and stuff like that, but to let a third party actually test it. So it's one way to deal with that.
That's a really good plan, I think, in my experience. But are there any final thoughts, anything else that you see commonly, or anything else you'd like to tell us about today?
You know, I think one of the things that people struggle with is not having a specialty provider, not having a Huntington's doctor. I know that access, you know, We have Center of Excellences and many more now throughout the country than historically we've ever had, but not everybody has access to that. And I think that the types of things that Help for HD does, as well as some of the other advocacy groups, to try to educate families, to help educate providers. I know that especially with moms, the moms with kids who have juvenile Huntington's, they get so tired of educating other people about how to care for their child. And I think we need to continue to make efforts to address their needs for sure.
And that's one thing that we are passionate about.
I know. So I think helping people access care that is meaningful to them is still a big challenge. Just because the majority of people in the country, sadly enough, but the majority of families in the country do not have access to a center of excellence still.
Right.
So,
They choose not to go to one for whatever reason.
Or they choose not, absolutely. Yeah, for one reason or another. And so helping to empower them, I think, is still a big challenge. There's all sorts of clinical questions that come up, all the time. And I think, like I said, we spend all afternoon talking about those, Sharon, but I think the most important thing for families is to find that confidant, that expert, whether it's a center, whether it's through your support group, whether it's through an informal network, whether it's through a chat room, whether it's through a Twitter feed, who will listen to you and help you get to expert advice. Because I did a lot of things when I was working at the center. I had a lot of hats. I saw patients, I managed things, I ran the center, I did research and da-da-da-da. But you know what my single most important job to me, the single most important thing I did was answer the phone for families who called in. Because they aren't calling unless they need to call. And being able to have someone on the other end of the line when you don't know what to do means everything. And so I think that our job is to help families connect to that, but also to encourage them to reach out, even if it doesn't happen to be, in your neighborhood, reach out to those experts and so that you get somebody on the other end of the line.
Yeah. And like you said, it doesn't have to be somebody local.
No,
if you know somebody, that you've maybe heard them speak, or read about them, or a place that has a really good reputation, like UC Davis, you can call whether you live near there or not.
Absolutely, you can. Absolutely, and we have to. We have to be able to have that access in our community, in our Huntington's community. We have to be able to have that access to each other. And I wish I could say every single person that I met in the Huntington's world felt that way. I think families will say, people listening to this will say, well, I call mine and I get the cold shoulder. I've heard of that. I have to say, and I don't want to discount somebody's feelings of not having been helped, right? I don't discount that at all. But my experience has been there's more people who want to help than don't want to help. And, it may take getting into your network to find somebody who might be able to answer questions. Come to one of our programs that we're doing across the country, and you'll have a captive group of people you can talk to there. I mean, that's just one small way to try to address that, Sharon, but there's nothing more frightening, I think, than facing something that is so hard as Huntington's and not feeling like you're not supported. And
right.
And you know, essentially it's our Huntington's community who cares about this. It's hard to generate that kind of passion in people who aren't connected with the Huntington's family. So we really do need each other.
Yes, we do. That having that network of support is one of the most important things in this journey. Because you,
yeah, I agree.
Without that, you feel so alone. You feel so isolated. And
yeah.
If you have that network of people that you can talk to, or you can email with, or you can go on Facebook with, it makes such a difference. Just to know you're not alone, and know you're not crazy. And that other people
right.
have gone through what you're talking about.
Yeah. It helps, you know, and I think the other thing, it definitely helps to talk to people who understand, you know, some of the problems that people face with Huntington's are some of the hardest problems I've ever seen in my life. I mean, this is sometimes the journey is relatively easy, but sometimes it is not. And so even more reason to help each other. But, you know, I think the other thing, too, is I would encourage folks to feel very hopeful. I know that it is so frustrating when you're watching someone get sicker and sicker day in and day out, and there still is no cure. I know how frustrating that is, but when I started in this, there was one observational study that people were doing, and nobody cared about funding Huntington's research.
Mm-hmm.
It was families who put up the money. It was families who did that. And now the government funds studies, pharmaceuticals fund studies, pharmaceuticals are funding family groups, for heaven's sakes, and biotech companies. We have so much brain power committing to try to crack this nut. It's a hard nut to crack, let me tell you. It's very hard.
Yes.
If it were easy,
yes.
It would have been
a lot
done.
More complicated than they expected.
Yes, it is.
When they finally found the gene. It, you know, I'll never forget that. I've been living with this since 1986. And I'll never forget when they found Jean and they said, oh, we'll have a cure within 10 years. And,
of course, now
it's been a lot longer than 10 years, but there's so much research going on. Just new
there's
things
so much more, Sharon.
Yeah.
I have a favorite. There is so much research. I mean, and you know, I feel very lucky to have been in the heart of a lot of, you know, promising therapies and things that, so I think people have a reason. I'm not trying to be overly optimistic. I think they have a reason to feel hopeful, if nothing more than the amount of effort, resources worldwide that is going into to try to make a difference for families. You know, I heard this quote by Maya Angelou recently, and I've actually stuck it on my computer so I see it every day. She had written that hope and fear cannot occupy the same space. Invite one of them to stay.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't that powerful?
Hope and fear cannot occupy the same space, invite one
of them.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
I choose hope. I choose hope to try to win out over fear, because there's a lot about the HD journey that's very fearful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
and
we should choose hope.
I agree. Well, any final thoughts, Terry?
Just thanks to your radio blog participants, whether through online or through the live show today. It's so wonderful for you to connect, and I feel really grateful to still be a part of this community. And Sharon, thanks to you and the other board members for Health for HD for everything you do to reach out to the community to make it a better place for us all.
Well, thank you, Terry. And thank you so much for being with us today. I've heard so many wonderful things about you from so many people in the HD community. And I'm just so glad that you're still working with us, even though you're retired. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us today, and we appreciate everything you continue to do to help our community.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. Now to the headline news. Austedo, which was in clinical trials as SD809, is Teva Pharmaceutical's new drug for Korea. It has been approved by the FDA, and it is now available to patients. Austedo is only the second drug approved for the treatment of Huntington's disease. Austedo, when compared to xenazine, was proven to have fewer adverse effects. If you would like to hear more about this new drug, listen to the April 12th interview with Dr. Sam Frank. You can find the episode in our Blog Talk Radio archives, and to obtain Austedo, talk to your physician. Secondly, this Saturday, April 22nd, Help for HD's second Hype Day, highly interactive participant education day that you heard Terry talk about, is being held at Evergreen Hospital in Kirkland, Washington. Registration, a continental breakfast, and lunch are all free to the HD community. To register, just contact Katie Jackson at Katie, that's K-A-T-I-E, at help4hd.org. Our third Hype Day will be held in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Embassy Suites Hotel at the Centennial Olympic Park on Saturday, June 3rd. To register for that one, you can contact me at Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N, at help4hd.org. The fourth Hype Day, we're trying to have these all over the country. So the fourth one is going to be in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, at the Clarion Hotel and Convention Center on Saturday, August 26th. To register for the Iowa Hype Day, contact Katrina Hamill, who's our Vice President of Operations, at Katrina, that's K-A-T-R-I-N-A, at help4hd.org. The final Hype Day for this year will be in Houston, Texas, at Baylor University on Saturday, September 30th. And again, to register for that one, you can contact me at Sharon at help4hd.org. Finally, don't forget about our annual symposium, which will be held Saturday, October 21st at the Bay Harbor Hotel in Tampa, Florida. To register for symposium, contact Katie Jackson at katie at help4hd.org. Flyers for each of these events can be found on our website, which is www.help4hd.org. That's all for today. Please be sure to tune in at the same time next week to hear Katrina Hamill's interview with a new guest. Thank you again for listening today. Have a good evening, everyone.